bills regarding campaign finance, House Bill 137 and House Bill 234. The consensus is that we will work on these bills during the interim as opposed to working on them today. It's not very realistic to get them passed both houses of the session with 1 week left in the session, and there is a fair amount of work that the committee feels we would like to do on those two bills. So if any of you are here for either 137 or 234, we will not be debating them today. Sorry. Okay, let's see. The next bill before us is House Bill 95. If the sponsor of House Bill 95 and House Bill 282 do not mind, I would like to go ahead and take up the two Senate bills very quickly, which I think we can dispense with very quickly. We've been asked by the Speaker to try and expedite the Senate bills if at all possible, so I don't believe that they will take very long. Senate Bill 38, Mike Clemens, I believe, is here for Senate Bill 38. Would you join us, please? Are you also going to speak?
Yeah.
238? Okay, I'm sorry, I didn't see. Alexis, I'm sorry, you are signed up. Thank you. Alexis, would you like to be first?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, my name is Alexis Gabbe, and I'm legal counsel for Senator Fakes, who's the sponsor of this bill. I apologize that she's not here today to present the bill to you. She's in the Senate State Affairs Committee right now. Senate Bill 38 is very straightforward, and I believe you have before you the Senate State Affairs CS to that bill, which would in effect require the Department of Public Safety to establish procedures for the standardized collection and recording of law enforcement and crime statistics in Alaska. If you have any questions, I'm available to answer them.
Are there any questions by committee members? Thank you, Mr. Fink. Mr. Clemens, do you have anything that you'd like to add?
No.
Does anyone have any questions? I think it's a pretty straightforward bill, and unless anyone has any problems, I just assume move it on its way. Yes, Representative.
All right. If there's no discussion, I would make a motion to move SB 38 out for individual recommendation.
Is there any objection? Without objection, then Senate Bill 38 moves. Senate Bill 152, regarding risk management. Let's see who we have. From the Department of Administration, Don Hitchcock.
Thank you. I'm Don Hitchcock. I'm the Director of Risk Management. About 3 years ago, the state had a relatively small self-insured retention. Premiums were extremely low and insurance was cheap, so we bought down. Premiums in the last two or three years have gone up quite measurably, as I think most of you know, and therefore they went up like four or five times or more. Therefore, in order to control costs, we opted for additional self-insurance. The state's deductibles now are anywhere from $50,000 for a Marine to $5 million for a liability and workers' compensation. We'd like to further increase these retentions in order to control our premium dollar spending, but we're simply not funded for catastrophe deductibles or retentions. And this bill is designed to develop a modest and reasonable catastrophe fund. There's a zero fiscal note on the bill. Because we intend to develop the catastrophe fund with the premium dollars that we save by increasing retentions. All of you should have a copy of our annual report in your folder. And if you turn to the next to the last page, you'll find this chart. And it very quickly explains to you where we intend to get the dollars to build a $5 million catastrophe fund. They're simply in saving the premium dollars that we would otherwise pay to insurance companies for the layers to $5 million, the layers of insurance.
Okay.
The bill itself is, I think, very straightforward. The first paragraph simply recognizes Department of Administration's responsibility to protect the state properties. It also recognizes the fact that the state is self-insured. The second paragraph provides for proper audit procedures for the Division of Risk Management and for the Catastrophe Fund. And it also provides to a fiscal report to both houses of the legislature every year in January so that you can tell where your risk management dollars are being spent, and also explains the program to you. The third paragraph provides for establishment of the Catastrophe Insurance Reserve Fund, and then the fourth paragraph outlines the method of funding. Any questions?
Are there any questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Hitchcock. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who'd like to testify on Senator 152? Is there any committee discussion? May I have a motion?
Yes, Madam Chair, we can move out SB 152 with individual recommendations.
Any objection? Okay, if not, Senator 152 moves out of committee. Thank you very much. Okay, the first House bill before us then is House Bill 95. Representative Taylor, would you like to join us? Thank you for allowing us to dispense with the Senate bills expeditiously.
We're doing it. We're going to do it throughout the body, and I appreciate seeing those moves. They're both good bills.
And you want your bill to have 10 feet.
Oh, okay.
We're kind of
on a roll here, so I'll intend okay.
I mean, their horses are off. I mean,
yeah.
You know, so.
Oh, no.
Okay, we have before us House Bill 95. Representative Taylor, it's been a while since we took hearings on this. You might want to just briefly refresh our recollection on that.
This is a historic gambling bill. It allows gambling in historic places. And it received a fairly strong support and the public testimony we had before the committee. There were only a very few people who did testify that were concerned about it, and they were generically concerned about all of the gambling bills. The committee recalls this bill was heard at the same time as the paramutual betting bill and I believe one other gambling bill. It doesn't go as far as some of the legislation that has been proposed. And it also leaves it up to local options, which is probably the most significant part of the legislation. The community would not have this within its boundaries unless they themselves agreed to do so.
Are there any questions for Representative Martin?
I still, one of the things that was held up on before was what we're going to call historic. Substantial historic gambling. Most of the historic gambling that we read about in Alaska wasn't too great. We also say that in Skagway we're going to leave it up with the city administration. Well, old Sophie Smith was the city administration in those days. we don't classify this. We put it during the era of 1890 and 1910, but there's been gambling going all over and minors, mostly in those days, all kinds of game on going on. So it doesn't need to be defined further so that there will be limitations. Probably the largest community, Anchorage, wasn't even born yet until
1941.
Anchorage, but okay. So we're out of that, which is odd for me.
Taylor, any definition for this?
I don't have any additional definition. I felt the parameters of setting it within those time constraints would probably be sufficient. And the local option aspect isn't up to the city administration. It's up to the people to make that decision. And I wouldn't be too fearful of too many Sophie Smiths being around. In fact, if I look at what's really available out there for me today and for other people today, if I want to play blackjack, I can go into almost any fraternal organization here in town or in Southeastern, and I can do it on a video machine. If I want to play a slot machine, we've got a new thing out now, paper slot machines called pull tabs. week, depending what town I'm in. And some of the bingo operations in this state, though we intended them for fraternal purposes, have been taken over by other purposes. I have some of the same feelings Representative Martin does about some of the gambling that presently is going on in the state. If this bill would limit and restrict gambling to just those historic areas and zones and eliminate all of the other gambling activities going on, then I probably think it would accomplish some of Mr. Martin's purposes. But basically what it does is it says that these activities may be available in given communities, and it limits it to the communities who have opted themselves to do it. I think that just supports the right of local option and franchise. We should encourage both districts.
Representative Davidson?
Go ahead.
Yeah.
Representative Taylor, this limits it geographically, right, to where this could take place. And why do you feel that this would be fair than the people who live in one geographic area and are able to do that, and other geographic areas who don't fall within the time frame and start gambling experience? How do you address the element of fairness? I mean, it seems to me.
I agree with you, Representative Davidson. I don't think that there is any fairness there at all. It's a historic accident, dependent upon what times and places may have had gambling within the state. Well, personally, my own philosophical belief is that it ought to be open as a question for each community. And there is legislation for that pending before the House. It's different from mine.
So then, if I may follow, is this a foot in the door then? Or you have no problem? Is your goal to ensure that gambling happens throughout the state?
No, my goal here is solely to support this piece of legislation. I was trying to answer your question on whether it's fair. And No, it certainly isn't fair in that aspect, because if we're going to be truly fair, we would treat all people equally across the board throughout the state, give them all that option. I think they all should have it. All I'm saying is that where it has been historically practiced in the past, those communities should have that option available to them today. And that's all. I'm not trying to expand it beyond that. I don't see it as necessarily any more, if you will, of a foot in the door than paramutual betting on horses.
Mm-hmm. Well, I voted against that, and I'm probably going to vote against this one. Representative Taylor, I don't know. You, with your background, you probably have more knowledge on the matter of gambling than I have, but I mean, your legal background. And I was just wondering if, in fact, with your knowledge, the argument often is made that gambling is sort of like a disease. I understand it that can be very addictive, and my concerns are, what impact would you foresee if this bill were to pass? What impact would we expect on, say, social service agencies, whereby the breadwinner of a family, say, would maybe dump the family's weekly earnings on such a historic gambling spot?
Well, were we living in a society where gambling were not presently allowed, tolerated, and even encouraged, I would say that this was the first opener, so to speak. I would say that we might see some detrimental increase to those departments. It would be very difficult to guess what that might be, especially when we look at other major factors. I don't think there's been a study conducted yet in the state that indicates that the wagering on bingo or pull tabs or the rest of it is a significant factor as far as our social service agencies. Primarily, not that it isn't a factor, but there are some other factors that are so huge in comparison that this would be de minimis. And those are alcohol, drug abuse, unemployment, and those types of difficult problems that we're facing. They so significantly impact these agencies that I doubt you find any meaningful statistics on the current practices of gambling that are ongoing. And then to ask the question, well, what impact will this have on those particular social agencies? I think it'll have a lot less impact than what they're seeing right now off the current poll tab, as an example. So, and because particularly we're limiting it to some very small, really cities and communities around the state.
It's nice to talk to you, Representative Taylor, because you keep bringing up these other points that I want to relate to this problem that I see as gambling. And you indicated alcohol. I don't know, I've been in a few gambling casinos in my travels, and I've never seen one that didn't serve liquor, which in my mind heightens the problem of alcohol as well as gambling. So I guess I have a lot of problems with this bill, and I don't like to tell people what to do, but I don't like to encourage this kind of behavior and thereby impact the family adversely or other, I think, services that the state is supposed to provide because of this kind of behavior is permitted. So I guess I don't have anything else to say, and I'll probably vote against this bill.
Regarding drinking, many establishments that I went to, alcoholic beverage, because of the profitability of these type of programs, alcohol was readily available free. And I see that you have an age of 21 to be admitted, and we have a drinking age of, 18, and we have a drinking age of 21. Do you see problems with those two different age limits?
No, I don't, because in fact, the communities themselves will regulate how these activities are conducted, and whether or not they're going to serve alcoholic beverages will be the actual key that will determine what age group is going to be there. Right now, as an example, you go down to the local bowling alley, and during certain times of the day or night, it all depends upon whether or not a particular gate is open or closed, whether or not people under the age of 21 are allowed in the bowling alley premises, and that's because alcoholic beverages are served there, and they regulate that quite readily. I don't think that would be a difficulty, and true, I've never seen very many activities like this going on without alcohol being available either, but I can imagine that there may be communities that may have had some historic gambling in them that would come under this bill that have now opted under legislation passed by this legislature to allow no alcohol in the community, and I can't see where they'd be in conflict with this. If you had a dry house, why somebody 18 in there would be any more subjected to alcohol there than he would anyplace else in town. I don't think he would.
The other concern, I guess, that I have is allowing the community to vote, and I don't see any provisions of opting out. Discussed opting out of second-class cities, and that's not permitted by law. And it seems as though if we don't permit opting out of this provision, opting out of gambling at a local community level, you know, they may initially say that they like the concept, after a while, after a year or so, they say that they don't want it. You know, I think that they should have the option of opting out and not be tied behind their, their hands behind their back.
I think, Representative Hoffman, that they can go either direction with that paragraph. Am I incorrect? It says they can only vote to do it?
I guess they can opt an ordinance. It doesn't say that they can, it says that you can introduce an ordinance that must be ratified by the voters to permit gambling, but it doesn't say that they can also vote it out. It says they can adopt it, but it doesn't say they can rescind that. The community can rescind it. They're just an adoption.
Well, we could probably get a legal opinion on that, but my own opinion would be that the ordinance itself would have to have the question on it, yes or no. And if you wanted to bring that up a second time or a third time later on, the question could be asked. We've certainly seen local option on alcohol within communities, and some of these communities have gone yes, then no, then yes, then no, and so on over the years. Their language on that, Representative Hoffman, is identical, I believe, to that. It says by local ordinance.
Would you have any objection to the possible addition of a section that would provide a mechanism whereby they could opt out?
Oh, no, and if it's not, if we have a legal opinion that says that's not clear or that they can't do that, I'd certainly say we ought to add that. I agree with Representative Hoffman completely on that. We ought to be able to go both directions.
Anything else, Representative Hoffman?
Since
this bill is as popular as the fair mutual bill in this committee as it went through. Every bill needs a two pass, right?
Actually, I think one no rec will do.
Somewhere in there. Well, Madam Chair, I think what we are looking at is we are looking at some the same argument that we had with the fair mutual on the local option, and whether it is where your feelings are, and I do support it. I think that we can go ahead and look at this type of legislation and move and put it on the local option and see if the folks have the opportunity to vote on it. And the ones that are opposed to it certainly have the opposition, as we are hearing, or the right to come forward and do that. And that is the part of the democratic process, and I will go ahead and support this legislation.
There is some additional testimony from the public, okay, would you tell you what, Jan Rentmore would like to speak on this bill. Is there anyone else that wishes to speak on House Bill 95 and Sally Smith? How about if we go ahead and take the additional testimony and keep the sponsor here? Or
one need him for two questions because the others are probably related to it too.
Okay, go ahead.
One, I definitely feel on line 27 we must amend that to 21 because our law says 21 for alcoholic beverage. If we just note down that a group that establishes historical gambling with the idea of having alcoholic beverages because that's part of the game is suddenly going to find themselves not allowed to have alcohol. We fight this situation in Anchorage every year, and I'm in favor of those that are against it. But we have affairs at the sports arena at Eden Center, and those that want to have special entertainment for kids and families, and then the main idea is to sell booze, and we find out the wives and kids are compliant with that guy that are drunk right there on the premises. I feel to make it a lot easier right now to stay in law 21, because that is our law. So game one for 21, and then the proprietors know that they're not going to have anyone. They're not going to have any trouble. There's time out there that we're number 21, because our major interest will be to raise money on alcohol. So I'd like to propose that as an amendment.
I have no objection to that. Consider it friendly amendment.
Then the people will never vote for it. And the other problem we're going to have is we mentioned municipalities in here. And technically, that's all it is. I think we need another term here to respond to that. Probably say local government and or municipalities, because if they said, well, you said only municipalities, and then when we have a technical definition of what a municipality means, maybe Skagway doesn't qualify or some other small town. So it's a technicality, but I think it's best now to address it, even though I don't like the bill. For your sake, it may be better to clarify that so that other local governments besides municipalities are allowed to. I don't know if that's in need of an amendment right now. I think it is. If you just say whether we say municipality or local government, whether they adopt the ordinance or whoever said municipality is followed by or local government.
It's beginning to sound like we will be doing a CS on this bill, both for the local opt-out section of the change of the years, and I think we can just ask the legal services to take a look at the appropriate language to include that concept represented.
That's only, well, I have a dozen other questions, I'm not sure.
I have no objection to that one.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to ask, you know, he talks about types of gambling, and I was just wondering if you could. What is that? Is that just blackjack and casino, or I mean, roulette, or?
Well, you mean in the phrase in there under historic?
Yes, it says may conduct only those types of gambling that occurred in the municipality during the period of 1890 to 1919.
Yeah.
What all does that include?
Well, it would depend upon the history of the municipality.
Oh, I see. You've researched it, or?
Well, what we have checked on is some of the municipalities and the types of games they had. Some of the games don't really exist anymore.
Slot machines,
various card games, and there's some of the card games, you know, you don't even hear about anymore. They're kind of like, I'm trying to think of it, like Pharaoh. Nobody plays Pharaoh anymore, but they were playing Pharaoh back in those days.
Well, I applaud your clever efforts at initiating gambling through historic preservation.
Well, we have a historic zone in Ketchikan designated as such. It's called Creek Street. And this bill was originally created. That's why the age 18 was in there, and I didn't catch that when we dropped it in the bucket here. This was Jack McBride's bill. And Jack's the one who originally sponsored this thing, and it was with the historic zone in Ketchikan, particularly in mind. Had a lot of support from those folks. There were other people like Skagway and other places that appeared as though they kind of like to do that too in certain limited historic zones. And we didn't foresee the overall finality of gambling as an evil invading the state kind of thing. We saw it more as something that would be used primarily during tourist seasons and that kind of thing. I personally don't foresee this thing turning into a bunch of big gambling casinos like in Las Vegas or something stacked up down there. There isn't a population base to support them in the first place. And nor do I see it really putting a big dent into the take that's presently being gotten off of gambling by various fraternal and social organizations. There may be some of that sharing that goes on, but I think really Sally's probably the best one to give you some indications on this, but I think that if we're really worried and concerned about gambling in this state, and we either want to regulate it, or we want to allow it, or we don't want to allow it at all, or whatever concept we want to take on it, I think if you had any idea of how much money is coming in just off of pull tabs right now, and the amount of money that is going on, that's tremendous. And I know one fraternal organization in my community alone that paid all their costs of operation, plus put $170,000 into remodeling, and contributed about 70-some thousand to charitable purposes, you know, scholarships and that kind of stuff, and did the whole thing off of basically off of full cash.
Well, it seems since you have, in order to be authorized, you have four things that the community has to meet, and it seems as though that you're really narrowing the scope down to a select few, but the one that I have concerns about is number two. You're saying that in order to qualify, the community has to have tourism, you know, and tourism isn't something that I think that, you know, there may be some communities that might want to participate in this program and they don't have tourism. It seems as though it's just benefiting the very, very select few communities, you know, maybe two, three, or four in the state.
I wasn't aware of any community that didn't have some tourism in it right now.
Well, it says depends substantially on tourism.
Well, again, Representative Hoffman, with your suggestions, those of Representative Martin, I think they're good suggestions. I don't have a problem with that one because it may very well be that, as you say, there are communities that don't have a substantial impact on tourism, have some, and would like to develop more, and this might help them in that development. I think that's something they ought to have available to them. But again, it was narrowed, I think, primarily so as to avoid opposition initially.
Yeah, the way we pinpoint this to historical districts and historical sites, and some of those aren't even available to us today. I might be up to Skagway, although I haven't been there for about 3 years. A lot of that was federal monies that was put into these historical sites and anchorage. Federal money were involved in the historical site, and I wondered if they may even limit federal government system. We can't do that because of our limitations on what these historical areas could be used for. Has anyone looked into that? Because we can say not only at locations that are in historical districts or perhaps established to preserve or create historical characters, and most of us get our money off that on the federal.
I can't answer that question. Apparently, Jan can. So.
Does the committee have any more questions of Representative Taylor before we turn to the witnesses? Jan?
Any more?
My name is Jan Rentmore, and I own the Red Onion Saloon in Skagway. And I also was chairman of the Skagway Convention and Visitors Bureau for 4 years during that time in 1983, we went to the public and had a vote and put this on the ballot, and the people voted in a special election to ask the legislature to enact this legislation. So we basically drafted this bill in Skagway. Our original proposal was modeled very much, just to give you some background, after Dawson. We did a lot of research on Dawson. We talked to a lot of local people there and to the people who run it. In Dawson, their system's a little bit different. The tourism department receives 100% of the revenues for this from the program, and the revenues are used exclusively to promote tourism for Dawson. We changed it because in Skagway we would like to see the money go to the municipalities, to the municipality. There is a lot of gambling in Skagway, particularly in the fraternal organizations, and that money goes directly to the clubs. So this would accomplish two things. It would provide some revenue for the community, for the municipality. We didn't see it as a huge revenue generator, but some revenue. And it also would enhance our tourism. We had hoped to use this as a way of enhancing what we call our shoulder season. Skagway's real busy from June 15th to August 30th, and the rest of the year since the closure of the railroad, it's been real slow. We were hoping to use this as a way to get people to stay in town a little longer, to come in the off seasons, perhaps attract some conventions. We did ask the Park Service superintendent there in Skagway to research for us if there was any provision that would interfere with our getting monies for historic preservation and or to prohibit this within the boundaries of a park. And as far as they could find, there was no restriction of that nature. It wouldn't interfere with any federal regulations. In Dawson, to answer another of your questions, they had a Gamblers Anonymous prior to their having historical gambling there at Diamond Tooth Gertie's, and they did not see any increase in the problem. The same people who had always had a problem still had a problem, basically, is what they found. They don't track their visitors, of course, but as far as the local community. Skagway City Council has endorsed the concept of a local option. They feel that people should, the community should be able to vote one by one. We don't know if Skagway would even vote for this at this time, but the local council felt that the community should have the option. Skagway's proposal was modeled very closely after Diamond Tooth Gertie's, with the exception that they did prefer a dry casino, at least to start out with. We have an old building on Broadway called the AB Hall, which is one of our most historic buildings, and the Park Service wanted to purchase that in a land trade deal, and the people voted to keep the building, but it's been a burden to the city because, of course, the city doesn't have the resources that the Park Service has had for renovating the old buildings. So we keep trying to find a way to pay for, to finance the restoration of that old building. And the concept behind this bill was to put one dry casino in the AB Hall. We figured we had room for about 14 blackjack tables. It was a very modest proposal. This law would not allow any new liquor licenses. It would not, as I see it, in any way create new additional liquor licenses. So any community that wanted to have to serve liquor on the premises would have to make use of an existing license. I don't believe that they could create, this does not create a new class of license. I think that's about all I have to add. I'd be happy to answer questions since Skagway did a lot of research on this. My information's a little rusty. I haven't testified on it for a few years.
Was it discussed on allowing the community or not allowing the community subcontract out any of those provisions? Sale of alcohol, gambling, use of facilities, so that all of it would have to be required to be municipally owned and operated so that the people would feel they had more of a say in the process?
Our original proposal that we went to the community, we had hearings in Skagway on this, and our original proposal was modeled after, I believe it's North Dakota, where they have charitable gaming. And what the North Dakota system is that some association, you know, Association for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, say, wants to make some money, they would come to the Red Onion, lease a corner, room for, say, one table. The charity would own the blackjack table. They have only blackjack in North Dakota. The charity owns the table. They hire somebody to run the game, and they keep all the money. So the bar has nothing to do with it other than the lease arrangement for the space. And we thought that that would work pretty well in Skagway, where the city owned the table, the city hired the dealer, and the city could lease in different places a table here or there. There has been no real increase, and I talked personally with the Attorney General's office in North Dakota. Now, this is about 3 years ago, but there was no increase in street crime. There was no increase that they could see in prostitution. There was no increase in organized crime in the state. There weren't any more muggings. The problem they had there was that they suggested that we put into this bill some percentage of the profits to go for enforcement to give the state back. But that was a problem in North Dakota, that the state had gotten a lot of complaints about what they called white-collar crime, where the dealer absconds with some of the funds, and the charity wanted the state to assist. So that could possibly be a flaw with this. But there was no increase in violent crime of any kind. Anyhow, we went out to hearings with that, and we heard very strongly from the community that they felt uncomfortable with it being spread out. They would like to start with a small, dry casino that was very carefully controlled, and if the city proved that they could control it, they possibly could branch out to more than one site. But there's nothing in this bill that would prevent that approach from being used by...
Would these leases be a fixed term that would be open for a bid on a semi-annual or some fixed term basis?
I think that's what they had in mind. Well, in Skagway, they had in mind to just do the one sole casino in the AV Hall. It's a city-owned building. It would be a city-run function.
Have you all exhausted your questions? No.
Thank you. Ms. McNamara, what percentage of voter turnout did you have in your special election?
I don't know. It was quite high, I think. But I can't recall. That was in 83.
Yeah. Now, you indicated that you would like to see some of the revenue go into the municipality. Did you establish in your studies what additional costs would be incurred by the municipality if you had historic gambling in Skagway?
We contracted with the National Gaming Institute, which I believe is in North Carolina. And they did a cost analysis. They did an analysis of our proposal. We sent them our proposal for a single dry casino in the AV Hall with 14. We told them how much space we had and what this ordinance said. And they said, okay, under this, or what the legislation outlined. And they said, under this proposal, you would have room for 14 tables. You would employ X number of people. And I sent those statistics to Elsa, and I should have brought them with me. I think it was 50 or 60 jobs over the years, something like that. The cost would be this. They would suggest this type of enforcement, and I would be happy to make that study available to the committee if they had concerns. There was going to be a profit for the city. It was not going to be a large profit, and our intention was never to make the city lots of money, just to make the city some money, but also to establish Skagway as a historic attraction.
But the effort, if I may, then, the effort though was certainly to ensure that the city was going to take more in than it paid out, or at least even,
yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. But I guess frequently it seems that when a city is gearing up for a new industry such as this, that if in fact the city does have a lot of additional costs, you have to make your city streets more attractive. You have more maintenance costs. You have perhaps more fire, more police kinds of costs. And so that's the reason behind my question. I have no further questions.
Any other questions, Ms. Randall? Thank you very much. Councilman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Sally Smith, Director of Public Services at the Department of Revenue.
I would like to note that there is a zero fiscal note on this because nothing in the bill reflects any responsibility of the state. I would also like to suggest that we don't have a philosophical position one way or the other. Consider that's within your purview. However, any legislation that does go through is not just a philosophical concept. There's generally something at the other end that has to work, and we do have a little difficulty with how this might work. For instance, there are a lot of elastic phrases in here. Depends substantially on tourism, has substantial history on gambling, enterprise enhances the historic character. There's no place where this determination is made. And presumably anyone could just decide that they have substantial everything and adopt an ordinance. There's no check and balance on the community's substantial history or anything else. And if anyone wanted to aggrieve another community starting up a gambling operation, there's no mechanism for that being heard, which creates a double problem where we at the state level are concerned. And most of my personal concern as head of an agency comes from having watched a bill that was crafted very loosely in 1960 be completely out of control. And several of you on this committee have heard me talk about this before. Representative Taylor's comments can be taken to heart yet another way. Many of the things that he brought before you are illegal under that bill. And we have no mechanism for getting a check. We have no staff whatsoever. We have no budget whatsoever. And we estimate that dollar for dollar, each dollar that's reported has another one being skimmed from the top. Video poker machines are not legal. Some of the things that he mentioned the organizations were doing with their money are not legal. There are no parameters within this bill, so there is no real check and balance. And you are entrusting through it a smaller organization with presumably fewer resources than the state to provide the oversight and the enforcement. If the state cannot provide oversight and enforcement on a state level, what position does that leave a municipality in who may think it's a great idea but not really recognize what they're getting into? Where will the liability rest? Who will be ultimately responsible? I would like to point out, too, on page 2, the first two lines. I'm not sure if my bill looks quite the same as yours. It looks to be a draft. Is this where it says may conduct only those types of gambling that occurred prior to or during 1899 to 10? Such restrictive legislation was also put in the charitable gaming bill and says games will be restricted to those that were played prior to 1959. I submit to you that it makes great enabling legislation language, but it never stands up because it's too easy to come in and get a gift the next year. So the current law for charitable gaming is absolutely riddled and completely destroyed by one-liners that have been added in subsequent years for very good organizations with very good intentions who wanted to do something different. And they got the permission to do it through the legislature on an individual one-at-a-time basis. That makes it even further difficult for any agency to enforce and to keep control of around it, of that. And the ceiling could be set anywhere under that by the municipality so that there are some controls. Those cover the bulk of my comments. I'm available for questions. And again, I would emphasize that what may appear a good, fair, excellent idea, when it's put into practice, may not have enough structure to make it be workable with the way each individual envisions it working. We all envision the best. We all hope for the best. We're optimistic, idealistic people who try to do the best for the constituency. I remind you that gambling in this state is illegal, and under the only permissible gambling, it's considered a privilege. And it's been very difficult to impress upon the charitable organizations that their legalized gambling is not a right, but is a privilege. And that any new gambling operation really needs to be able to carry the same level of responsibility so that we don't turn it into a right that then gets convoluted into something that we are not capable of controlling with the resources currently available to us. It requires a lot of resources. And if they're not there, you may have problems you don't anticipate, nor do you believe they'll exist. So.
Questions? Representative Davidson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Historically, Ms. Smith, has gambling ever been legal, actually legal,
statehood.
Prior to statehood?
Yes. Madam Chair, it's my understanding many things were legal prior to statehood. And with the coming of statehood, there were many things that were changed. It may have actually been changed prior to that, but yes, it was legal.
Is there any way you could expand on the debate that the company statehood outlined the gambling?
Madam Chair, through you to Representative Davidson, I was not here prior to statehood. I know mostly the stories that were told in relation to Fairbanks, and I believe it was primarily local control at that time. Some of the operations were not legal, and there was certainly no control, and many of the stories that I have, which were told to me as stories, related to the people who came in and went out, not the people who stayed within the community. And it was, you know, kind of the where the game was and what the jokes were about who made what from whom, and high stakes. Now, we all know those things do go on now, and no legislation is going to stop gambling. There's probably a pool on right now as to what hour you will all adjourn, you know? There are pools when people's babies will be born. They're not legal, but we don't go in and necessarily enforce them. I think the state's general concern is when it gets into high stakes and when it impacts on the resources of the state because there's a problem.
Any other questions from Ms. Smith? I guess I'd like to ask just a little bit about the resources available to do any kind of enforcement on this at all. What exactly is the current status of Department of Revenue resources available for even the current gambling non-charitable organizations? One person?
Current status, zero people are budgeted, zero amount is available for resources. Prior to August, we had one investigator on board with no resources. No secretarial backup, no travel money, no money for telephones or anything else. We just kind of borrowed from other allocations. In the budget for 88, there is an investigator three and $10,000 for travel. The $10,000 for travel will not work up a good investigation and see us into the court system. There's no way you can do a decent investigation for $10,000, and that's on only one. In order to do a proper build-up, we have 1,000 charities now with permits. That's up 20% over a year ago. Everyone is looking for a way to make some money, and they feel that this is easy and you don't have to do much. There's very little understanding of how easy it is to juggle books where you're dealing in cash. And all your gambling operations are cash operations, so it's incredibly easy to dummy things up. Many of the rooms are dark. It's extremely easy to counterfeit items and not have them easily detectable. It's also, for instance, the pull tabs become difficult for the players because they can, in a darker room like a bar, they don't realize they have a winner. They discard their winners. That's more money for the house. That generally isn't reported. It will be reported as a paid-out prize, although it's always you report the maximum prizes. And we discovered that Mickey Mouse won many of the prizes. Last year we had, I believe the top money winner in the state last year that was reported was Richard M. Nixon. And those are certainly people that are using fictitious names. It's a serious situation. We use two staff within our compliance section to issue the permits and do a cursory review of the annual financial statement. Reported as of January 31st were $48 million, and that's only 53% of the charities reporting by the required statutory reporting deadline. We legally could revoke every permit of the other 47%. Were we to do so, the phones would absolutely drive you crazy, and no doubt you would ask us to please reinstate their permits. It's a highly political situation that is further complicated by our inability to do things properly. In order to do things properly, we would have to decide what we were going to do across the board and look at each permittee for the same thing, identify where we had cases, work up the cases, and file them all so that we could not be accused of selective enforcement as we were on the one case we worked up 2 years ago. And it was a legal, I shouldn't say use the word legal, it was an appropriate complaint that we had only worked up one case. On the other hand, we only had one investigator with very limited liabilities. So yes, that's part of it. Any of these that get enacted just create further problems for us, because they're generally, the fiscal notes are shortened on them. And then they go, well, the agency doesn't need that. So I noticed, for instance, the fiscal note that ended up with Paramutual Gaming. All the staff's been cut down to part-time. You cannot oversee a gambling operation, even if it's seasonal, on a part-time basis if you're going to do an investigation. It's a year-round event.
Yeah, right. On the to the chair, to Ms. Smith, on the Paramutual, we were establishing a racing commission that would go ahead and oversee the aspect of it, would it not?
Madam Chair, through you to Representative Menard, idealistically it will. Practically, I doubt that an organization that's volunteer will have a chance. What we find with charitable gaming is these are volunteers, and they're looking for any opportunity that they possibly can to delegate the responsibility to someone else. They're more than willing to pay to have it done. But the people who are willing to do it for them are not the people that care about the organization. They're the people that care about the profit. And that's where your problems lie. I don't think it's the gambling itself. It's not the fundraising itself that's the problem. It's the peripheral people. And if you even look at this bill, the history of the state, people came up here to mine. Miners didn't get rich. The people in support services did. And they didn't generally get rich honestly. They got rich by cranking up the prices and taking advantage of what money was there. And that's kind of what we have when we have an industry like this. If it's not carefully regulated, somebody makes a profit that's not within the what we would call honest boundaries.
I agree with everything, Sal. And that's why I submitted this bill, because it'll be regulated and managed by municipalities, not by some underfunded bureaucracy sitting in Juneau.
Any other questions from Sally?
No.
Thank you very much, Ms. Smith, for coming back to say a word. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 95 who's not yet had an opportunity? No other public testimony. Okay, Representative Martin.
Well, Tim, we've got some major issues that I think we really need to look into. One of them is the Constitution makes it very clear that we will not have any special legislation that favors one geographical area over another. But only if we should to get, because it doesn't go to judiciary, I noticed, that we should get an opinion from the Attorney General that this is not special geographical legislation. To me, it is. But I think that we brought out before, all communities are not going to be treated equal. And I have been asked a number of times in Anchorage that they finally gave up on me and asked other people to allow all kinds of types of gambling. But, you know, this historic stuff has a nice little image to it, and tourism has some of the backup stuff here, especially from AG, Alaska Travel Bureau. Thousands and thousands of people are going to come here to gamble. Why should they come here to gamble? They'd be better at Atlanta or Vegas or someplace else. And then also, I perceive that we are going to have problems, whether it's municipal control or not, but you are going to come and have tourists that come in and have problems and maybe go overboard and gamble away too much money, and then they can't get out of state, and then it becomes a state problem. You ship them out or take care of them or whatever. But the Attorney General opinion, I think, is very much needed. We should also list the type of gambling. I know that card games were popular. Slot machines were available in those days. I'm like Miss Smith, I wasn't around there either, but I did read it all the administration. Russian roulette was available, but we don't want to allow that. Roulette machines themselves weren't available. So we should define, because it's going to come back to the state anyway, if we don't define what types of games are available. The other parts that we need to really look into, since this is going to be local municipal elections, is the Department of Election, and it's going to be called to them, because they are responsible for various types of local elections to oversee them. And I presume there's going to be a certain cost to them to be eligible for voting in certain communities and so on and so forth. And that to be checked out. It may only have 10 ideas are nice, but this thing here is so general that when you get into specifics, then the state is constantly going to be asked, do we qualify, what don't we disqualify, and what kind of a bill was that they passed through, my town isn't allowed, and their town isn't allowed.
Any other committee member comments or questions? Representative Taylor, did you have any?
I was just going to be here to respond to the concerns. It won't be a question for the state. It'll be a question for the municipality, whether or not a particular game, or whether or not a historic zone, or whether or not something even was historically done. It'll be a determination made by the municipality. The state will have no involvement in this.
State law.
The state law authorizes the local municipality at their option to enter into this. And as Jan Rentmore testified, their community has some very strong concerns about how they will go about it, if they even do. And that, I mean, they were talking about the type of leases, whether something would be owned by the city or not owned, and so on. There's no need for us in Juneau to get concerned about setting the price of a bet, telling the community how or what it should or should not do, or defining for the community whether or not it in fact does come within these parameters. They will make that decision themselves. And we've very narrowly structured within this bill some definitional terms that'll have to be used by the cities, not by the state. The Smith's department will have no involvement in this piece of legislation. Right now, we are allowing, from her testimony, somewhere in the neighborhood of $100 million of gambling going on. We are not even budgeting anybody to look into it. No, I don't want to pass another bill where the state will be responsible for enforcing gambling in this state. That's why this is left up to the municipality. I think they'll do an awful lot better job of it than we've been able to do. I know they're going to have a lot more concern about it than we are.
Well, if there are no other either comments or questions, I would like to have a CS prepared that for people to look at, not to take action on today, obviously, but that would incorporate the 18 to 21 at least, adding the opt-out election, which Representative Kaufman mentioned earlier, the or local government language that Representative Martin mentioned, which is on line 23, and people can think about some of the other issues which have been raised, either listing specific types of gambling or other changes you might want to add, and we'll have it back again as a CS and also be available for other amendments if people happen at that time. Representative Kaufman.
Throughout, you know, in different states, they allow gambling, and the state benefits financially through lotteries or, you know, gets a piece of the action, so to speak. And I wonder if, in areas where potential vices are gambling, and even the state of Washington handles all liquor stores, and they take the revenue and utilize that revenue to provide the social services to the individuals that may need them. And I wonder, you know, we haven't done that in the past, and I wonder if we're contemplating this gambling vice, that there may be the gambling and all this stuff, something that may need funding. Maybe we should consider looking at a slice of the pie for the state of Alaska.
I think we should. Out of $100 million that's presently going on out there right now, we ought to probably be taxing these charitable organizations at a very high rate for what they're currently doing. We also ought to be enforcing the laws we have on the books, Representative Hoffman, and maybe some of this would be cut down dramatically. But we're not doing any of that.
But in your legislation as well, maybe look at that, but while we have this bill, address that issue in this bill.
It wouldn't affect this bill, because this bill is only going to occur in a very limited number of communities around the state.
Well,
those communities are presently funding, partially, at least.
Well,
I know
what I'm saying is whatever the gate is, say, in these communities, a percentage of the profits, gambling profits, be reverted to the general fund, 10, 15, 20, 30, 50%. The state of Alaska has to provide services just as much as the municipalities have.
Okay, can you do that in your mutual service?
Yeah, I can't remember what the percentage was, but there is something like that.
Seems to me, under that theory, I
municipalities, and primarily what we're looking at is the state, you know, authorizing, but what is the state's obligation afterwards if it's a municipality? It's been a question how much should be coming back to the state. I can see where, you know, we are spending state dollars on the parimutuel on that business, but something should be coming back, but, you know, that it's open to debate whether we should be or shouldn't be.
Well, we'll all take that into consideration and give that some thought. Representative Martin.
Madam Chairman, before this gets out of committee, I'd like to ask a request that the committee get a statement from the Department of Elections. If it's gonna, because I'm sure they're gonna be involved in it.
I do have that on my list, and
then
also
the
Attorney General's.
Pertaining to the constitutional question, is this fair, and is it, if we had gambling before the Constitution, and that always been added to the fact that all communities will be treated equally.
We will ask staff to get answers to the questions.
Horse racing.
Thank you very
downtown
much. Okay, House Bill 282. Thank you, Representative Taylor. Representative Hudson is with us. Smoke detection devices.
Madam Chairman, technically speaking, there was a question. The motion was brought up. Is that going to be put on?
He didn't actually make a motion.
Oh, okay.
Representative Menard was saying that he supported it, but he did not make a motion, so we have not taken any action.
I believe an objection to that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for taking up 282 at this late date of our session here, but felt that it was very important. Have with us Gordon Brunton, who is State Fire Marshal, and Stephen Shows with the City and Borough of Juneau with the building. What is your title there?
Chief Building Inspector.
And Bob Haig with the Fire State Fire Association. Fire, I guess you're the lobbyist for the State Fire Association. Mm-hmm. 282, Madam Chairman, basically is an act relating to smoke detection devices and was submitted at the request of Mr. Stephen Shows, who, as we said, is a building inspector for the City and Borough of Juneau, as well as a representative of the Alaska Southeast Chapter of the International Conference of Building Officials. And the current statutes, Alaska Statute 1870-095, has been interpreted to mean living units built or sold after 1975. So this legislation will kind of fill that gap. If you've heard all the gambling bills that you want to hear, this is a non-gambling bill. This is a preventative bill. And the intent of Section 1 of this bill is to require all homeowners to install and maintain smoke detectors in their homes, regardless of when the home was constructed or purchased. And Section 2 addresses the responsibility of landlords and tenants relating to the installation and maintenance of smoke detectors in rental units. And I understand, and I think this committee has probably received a copy of Senate Bill 266, which has expanded or made more clear some of the language that we'd like to have in here. And we certainly no problem with that change. If it's the committee's desire, we wouldn't have any problem. And we've heard also from the people that ask us to introduce this, that they would be acceptable to Senator Duncan's companion bill. The 1985 annual report submitted to me by the Division of Fire Prevention, Alaska Department of Public Safety, states that Alaska leads the nations in death by fire. And of the 29 Alaskans who died in fires in 1986, 27 were in their homes, which are either single or multi-family dwellings. And the finding in that report clearly demonstrates the continued need to install and also to maintain smoke detectors. And we also have additional backup information, and that is in Alaska, detectors operated in 7.3% of all fires. And no fire deaths occurred in Alaska where operating detectors were present. And in 24% of all fires in Alaska, no detectors were present. And there's an indication that in the presence of operating detectors, property losses are less than where there are no detectors. We have these three gentlemen with us here today. I view this as a pretty straightforward piece of legislation submitted, of course, at their request, but one that I'd hope that you'd see favorably with. And I'll answer any questions.
Are there any questions? My only question is why my name doesn't show up as a co-sponsor. I thought I'd add it on, but I'll talk to the chief clerk about that. Is there an enforcement of this? I mean, what is the...
Madam Chairman, I think that probably most of this will apply to new constructed of single and multifamily dwellings in the state of Alaska. And it'll also probably apply pretty heavily to reconstruction that takes place. And I asked the question of Stephen as to how this would apply as far as enforcement is concerned. And you'll notice that it is not it's a non-punitive piece of legislation for the most part. It's a strong statement. And it probably would occur when there's a report of the absence of a functioning device. Of course, upon application of a permit in order to reconstruct or to add on to a house of this nature, or when one has been reported, in which case, because it would be the law, it was in there. And so that's the answer that I can give you.
Representative Martin, did you have a question?
Yes, got on to two main things. I was wondering the enforcement and penalty. I think that maybe in my mind that the underlying penalty may be the insurance liability for someone that does not have such protection or a device, preventive device. And then if they did have an accident, the tenant could very well, or a smart lawyer, could bring that up in a court case. Bring it up if a relative severely got burned, and part of the problem was that this individual goes along the land, and damages should be increased 10 times. I think it's like seatbelt legislation in court in England. The state now said that if you don't wear a seatbelt, you're liable not to receive the benefit that you think you're going to get in an accident. And also, calls of inspections. It seems to me that maybe that in the permit process, whether the local or statewide permits for home building and so on, that something like this could be done rather than the fire department having to inspect every new dwelling that's going up. Looking at an easier method to ensure that these are in new buildings.
Yes, Madam Chair, through the Chair. Representative Martin, I think probably that the current building inspection process probably would take care of this. And having it in the law would be a strong statement that, and perhaps one of Stephen, you might be prepared to respond to that as to whether additional inspection is required or an additional agency inspection would be envisioned. Yeah, I think it would be a part. I believe it would be a part of the normal permit process like any other building code requirement that we have, except this would be a statement on the part of the state. And I've noticed in a number of other legislations as we were going through some of this here that we do make strong public policy statements in law that influences the level of inspection standards and things of this nature. Schools, for example, and a lot of other areas.
So, I have concerns about how, you know, many of the distance for utilizing smoke detection devices are in northern climates where it's required to keep units, heating units at a high level, which result in fires. And many of these are in rural areas that don't have fire departments, don't have building inspectors, and don't even have people to respond to fires. And I think it's those areas that need these devices the most. But it's very hard for the state to go out and require these, even when it's on the books. So I can see a great need for these devices, not only to be installed, but also to be maintained. The practicality of that happening in rural areas, especially northern rural areas, is not. I don't think it's practical.
Mm-hmm.
And I also have the concerns about Representative Martin says that many people, on lawsuits may be claimed against them for injury to someone in their residence for not maintaining the system. And I wonder if fire companies can do the same thing, even though you have an insurance policy and it says you shall be in compliance with all state laws, and they come in and prove that you didn't maintain void because you didn't maintain your devices and your whole home is burnt down and you're not in compliance and you don't get any loan.
Chair, I don't have the answer to that because I've not examined that from a legal point of view, and I'd suggest that might be a good question to examine. We can certainly refer that to our legal division, but they helped us draft this thing, and we assumed that we had a satisfactory bill here.
Any other questions for Representative Hudson? If not, I'd like to call on Stephen Jones, Senator Regino.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome to stay with us.
Yes,
sir. Let the record reflect that Representative Davidson and Donnelly are with us.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the KID Committee, for the opportunity to speak here today. I'll keep my comments brief in the interest of time. And I am here today representing the building officials within the state of Alaska, who are organized in three chapters, and I'm president of the Southeast Alaska chapter this year. We do recommend a committee substitute on this bill to reflect the language in Senate Bill 266. There is confusion about the present law, and I think the comments here today are fairly typical of that. This bill will clarify that smoke detectors are required in all dwelling units and define the responsibilities in landlord-tenant situations. Currently, only Juneau and Anchorage require these devices in all dwelling units. In 1985, state fire marshal statistics indicate that of all the dwellings that had a structural fire, 58% of them did not have a smoke detector installed. These devices are low cost, and they protect us while we sleep in our homes and are most vulnerable to death by fire. Alaska has the highest ratio of per capita fire death in the United States year after year. This bill will save lives in our state. We urge your favorable consideration. There were questions, Madam Chair, on enforcement. Perhaps if I could speak just briefly to that point. It's true that the state of Alaska has very limited resources, not only in fire safety inspections, but all manner of building regulatory control. The state fire marshal's office does not have jurisdiction in single-family homes for routine inspection. City fire departments do not have jurisdiction in single-family homes. Building inspectors have jurisdiction. So this is a situation that cities like Juneau and Anchorage that require smoke detectors in all devices work with people when it comes to our attention that there is no smoke detector. We inform them of the fact invariably. If they know it's a requirement, they see the benefit, they install the smoke detector, and it's not a confrontational situation. The fact is many communities in the state do not have building inspectors, and so the enforcement that currently exists there historically is going to continue. Where we got involved in this legislation was in an effort to provide smoke detectors to children in our school system that lived in homes without them. The firefighters donated money, purchased smoke detectors, and gave them to families that didn't have one. What we found is the families were very grateful to that, and they asked, why don't I have one as a matter of law? They're obviously beneficial to us. Does my landlord provide it? Do I? There was confusion. You would have to ask questions as, when was this house built? Has this house ever been sold? Clearly, we're talking about something low cost with a very high benefit of saving lives. We can't speak to the enforcement that occurs in a rural community in our state and how successful we'll be in getting smoke detectors in each home, but we feel that having a common law that says we care enough about our citizens to protect them when low cost, reasonable measures are available sends a strong signal. It also gives local communities who don't have laws such as Juneau and Anchorage do a little emphasis to draft legislation and start education programs in this area. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Representative Martin.
You mentioned the local law. How many communities do have it, like does Anchorage and Fairbanks have?
The requirement for smoke detectors in all buildings is unique. Only Anchorage and Juneau require it in all buildings, and this includes mobile homes, which are traditionally regulated by the federal government through the Interstate Commerce Clause. Mm-hmm. There are all communities who have adopted uniform building code in the state. Uniform building code requires smoke detectors in all new buildings and all remodeled buildings. They can be battery operated in remodeled buildings. So when someone goes through a permitting process in a municipality with building inspectors, they are brought up to speed. Smoke detectors are a new technology. They're basically part of the NASA program in the 60s where they were developed. And so that technology is something that should translate back to houses that were built in the early part of the century even. And it's just some method of uniformly doing that that is problematic. And that is what this bill represents.
We're seeing enforcement, to confess. I didn't do that about Anchorage. I don't have one in my home. My neighbors had one, the neighbor and neighbor had them next door, and I thought, oh, I'm pretty safe. I heard my neighbors downstairs go off one time, but I better get one. What's, you know, there's still fires in Anchorage, especially in the mobile homes. And, you know, so they have the local ordinance. Is it really having that much of an impact? And if the major communities have that, then this looks like it's going to be legislation that's going to be for the oil areas, and perhaps, as you said, there's some way to reach them. But if they don't have the means of buying them, you know, the plunge club in Anchorage contributed so much money for these smoke alarms to be given out to homes. And looking at the practicality of it, even if they don't, even the education.
We have been talking about that while you were out of the room, that it's not really so much an enforcement question as it is a setting a standard that says that this is what
well,
it ought
then
to
then
be.
Would you make it at all, as a husband agrees with me, then those people who were least knowledgeable of law and who were just barely making ends meet now, it's not that they can't afford it, there's no stack of alarm, it's not like people in the nation. Suddenly you decide to get back what you should be getting back to your home when it burned down, and you find out, oh, no, what's wrong, you don't know.
Anchorage does have a law requiring smoke detectors in all buildings, and to my understanding, there is no problem with people that have fires, don't have smoke detectors in this regard. Obviously, the world is not perfect, and we won't have compliance with all state laws at all times. This is an effort to have a uniform law that makes good sense and apply it to all people in an effort to save lives.
Well, I'm considered above, maybe I think it's that way. Not to say I'm a considerate above as acknowledged, but I never knew that.
Anything else for Mr. Shows? Dad, Gordon, Brendan, do you have something?
I have one question.
Yes,
okay. On dwelling units, what does that all entail? You refer to the Alaska Statutes 34036.
That statute is in the landlord-tenant area of state law, and it defines dwelling unit as a, there are two definitions of dwelling unit. One is in statute, and so we stayed consistent with that one. The other one is in the Uniform Building Code that Gordon's department has adopted by regulation. It basically includes a home. If you have cooking facilities, bathing, living facilities, apartment, condominium, house, duplex, triplex, anything where people or a family can live is considered a dwelling unit. This is used in a definition of dwelling unit in the landlord-tenant section of statute.
Schools, churches?
No. Dwelling unit where a family lives. Where people are sleeping, this is what a smoke detector does, is it alerts you to fire when you're asleep. So if you use that mentality, a motel, I think, is defined within the bounds of dwelling unit. So if you look at it as where people sleep inside a building, that's probably going to be covered in the definition of dwelling unit.
Thank you very much. Mr. Brunton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Deputy State Fire Marshal Gordon Brunton, representing the Department of Public Safety. Contrary to the initial testimony of the bill sponsor, I do view this as a gambling bill. I think it's a gamble if you don't have smoke detectors where you sleep or live.
Okay.
Let's try and put this in perspective. We've heard a lot of witnesses throw statistics around about Alaska's fire deaths. They've stated that they're roughly 2.5 times the rest of the national average per capita. If we had, on a monthly basis, one fully loaded 747 and one fully loaded 727 crash head-on at 30,000 feet every month, that would be the equivalent of about 6,000 deaths. Fires happen in ones, twos, and threes. In fact, there were three young children that died at the Nome yesterday, or two of them yesterday and one this morning. Not in a dwelling, of course. Probably not much we could have done, yes, in that barge to prevent that. But anyway, we have been working on primarily an educational process to get detectors into homes. And in response to some of Representative Hoffman's questions, we have worked through the University of Alaska to develop a desensitized detector, or a detector that could be shut off when a false alarm through a cooking, smoky toast or whatever, and then could be turned back on. One of the problems with that is the detectors are based upon National Bureau of Standards requirements, and to get them to lower those for unique cases is very difficult to do because of the liability potential. We have been working with the Department of Community and Regional Affairs in training weatherization contractors. Their program goes out and helps to conserve energy in the houses, and one of the provisions in their weatherization program was that any dwelling that did not have a detector would be so equipped. And they found that in fiscal year 1986, out of 1,600 residences that they weatherized, 75% of them did not have detectors. There is a provision in the statute that provides for $500 fine or 6 months in jail or both for violations of any of the provisions of that particular statute along with the others. And historically, we have had cases when the original statute was enacted from purchasers of dwellings that found they didn't have them, and the argument became whose responsibility was it, the purchaser or the seller, and we would investigate those, and we feel we do have the authority to enter a private dwelling based on a complaint like that and with the proper legal procedures. And if it ever came to the point of prosecuting, those are the penalty provisions provided by AS 1870.100.
We're talking about rental units or motels here. We're talking about individual family homes.
These are individual family homes, duplexes, triplexes, whether they're privately owned or whether they're rented.
I mean, if somebody sells their house and they don't have a smoke detector in their own house, that other people, you go and investigate that? Or?
We had probably Representative Donnelly half a dozen instances between 1976 when that law became effective and now, and all of them were resolved with phone calls. There was never any real investigation other than the fact that we had a complaint and we responded to that to the owner or the seller, and they purchased the $10 detector.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Just one question, Madam Chairman, for me. Is it possible that when they get building permits for homes or whatever, that the local government who is monitoring those permits have, as part of the code, the building code, the home code, fire detectors?
Yes, sir. Through the chair, Representative Martin, the current codes provide for those requirements, and anybody that is issued a permit is inspected for that. I believe Mr. Schultz will support that. But what we're saying right now is we just have, I sell my house to you.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remodel it. I don't do anything other than just sell it to you if it doesn't have any detectors in it. By law right now, that's required.
I'm sorry.
It's the imposition is on the seller to have the detectors in it.
And then an all new home is being built, that's part of the whole state.
That's correct. The Department of Public Safety supports the intent of it. We feel it can properly be handled through an educational process. We're pretty much neutral on who's responsible for maintaining it.
Any other questions, Mr. Clinton? Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Any other public testimony? The sponsor of the bill indicated that he would prefer we adopt a CS, which would incorporate changes which are in Senate Bill 266. So if there is no objection, I will go ahead and have such a CS prepared. Representative Martin?
In the technicality, is that so for expediency? Why don't we just say 266?
We don't have 266.
Oh.
Senate bill has not yet passed the Senate.
He's having trouble with that.
So what I would propose that we do is adopt a CS for House Bill 282, which incorporates the additional language in Senate Bill 266.
Okay.
Is there any objection to adopting such a CS? Could I have a motion then also to pass it out with individual recommendations?
So moved.
Thank you. Without objection,
I thought you had someone to do it for you.
You owe me one, right?
Yeah.
Can we put a delay date here so I can get home and get one in?
Minority members' bill is only appropriate.
I know,
did you get to make that motion for Representative Hudson?